Voices Radio Network.
The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Welcome to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, a new voice in bodybuilding podcasting.
Welcome back to Muscle Minds. I'm Scott McNally, and with me, of course, every episode, Dr. Scott Stevenson. What's up, man? How you been?
I've been busy. Traveling fool. Yeah.
Yeah. What's been going on?
Zipping around. Oh, I just, I've got the body power thing. I'm trying to spread the word on that. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Dude, I've been seeing the posts and stuff, man. I'm pumped. I'm jealous, but I'm jealous. like I said to you, I'm jealous in a good way.
I wish you could come. I mean, literally, it would make total sense for you to go over, you know, at some point as literally a tax write off a business trip, because
that's true.
There's so many interviews you could do.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Continually. I mean, and you've interviewed a lot of these folks.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're making connections now with all the UK interviews you're doing.
I would like to think that I'm an honorary British guy now.
Yeah. Well,
Not quite.
Evan Santapani has been on the Size Game. Several times now, but fairly recently. He's going to be over there. I saw that.
Oh, nice. That's perfect.
I don't think he'd been before, but they just love him because he's got a great, like, get it done.
Yeah.
Brit of attitude. Yep.
Yeah. His work ethic makes total sense with those guys.
Yeah. And he's also, I mean, I listened, I don't think Luke was on that. Maybe not. I get the episodes mixed up. Maybe Luke was on there, but, I remember James saying after their interview that, you know, he was just so impressed that Evan can hold a conversation about things other than bodybuilding. Is that?
Oh yeah.
And they spent time together. I think James may have actually stayed with Evan for a while.
Oh, that's cool, man.
Yeah, yeah. So, it's people. More and more people are known about it. Chris Bearcat, who's here in town, is going over. I think he's actually already. They have already left. He's leaving today. I'm not sure where he's staying.
Okay, so he's getting there before you, and then he's staying longer than you too, right?
I don't know what day he's leaving. Actually, he wasn't. His sponsor is bringing him over. So, you know how that is. A lot of times, people it's kind of bizarre. They don't even have the room set up. You know, people don't know till literally they land where they're going to stay, but they always seem to figure it out.
Yeah.
So, but he'll be over there, and you know. He's a natural competitor, an American, but you know, the world is getting smaller. So
Chris is, we're going to have Chris on one of the episodes here. Not too far down the road, aren't we?
I hope. Yeah. I hope
I would like that.
We'll see. I've mentioned to him if he and I can hook up, cause I don't know what hotel he's staying in. So I'll maybe see him, but he'll be at his booth.
Yeah.
It's funny. I was playing I really like body power. I just had a good time over there pretty much every time I've gone. Like, but it's like expos, and it may even be louder than the Arnold.
Is that possible?
You wouldn't think so, but I was, my parents didn't wear, so I talked to some of the parents yesterday, and they don't really know much about, they said, how many people will be joining over there? like about over 100,000. Like, oh, okay. So I showed them some videos and of just the expo, and I remembered how friggin' crazy loud it gets.
See, now I would not expect that. I think of the UK. I think of like very proper gentlemen, not like us loud, obnoxious Americans that are firing T-shirts out of cannons at people. You know.
They do all the same stuff.
Oh shit.
There's tons of guys walking around with their shirts off, and that's probably what they're supposed to do.
Right, right.
They're trying to pull people over. When I stayed at Joe Binley's booth last year, For much of the time, he just said, hey, if you need a place to hang, you can come over here. And he had a supersized booth with a back storage area for all their inventory.
Oh, cool.
So it was walled off. And there was no conversation even possible out at the front of his booth, because just across the way from him, he was almost on the perimeter. Literally on the perimeter wall was a company that was selling apparel.
Okay.
And they had a nightclub going the entire time.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, they had I think a little stand with a kind of a stripper pole.
Oh god.
And someone up there dancing and smoke, and it was so loud. It was crazy loud. They wouldn't turn it down.
Yeah.
We were sitting there, we'd watch people, and people would come around past that, and you'd see like women would like bury their heads in their boyfriend's jackets to get some safety away from the noise. It was so loud.
Wow.
They people, it was actually pushing people away.
Huh.
Yeah, but they kept it up. So yeah, it's kind of your typical expo that can, you know, if you get a headache going, it ain't stopping. You're gonna have to leave.
You're gonna need to take some extra pre-workout then, is what it sounds like. When you get there, get some samples out. Now, you're doing a bunch of talks. That's what you're going to be there doing, right?
Yeah, they're putting me to work. What is different from, I think, the Arnold and the Olympia for sure. They have several events. They've got a CrossFit type of thing and some powerlifting events. You can go on bodypower.com and see what's going on. But they've got several different areas that are educational oriented. So they've got like a body power gym, and I was there a couple years ago demonstrating some stuff.
Okay.
And then one of the areas is called Evolution of Bodybuilding, and they have a gym set up there, some equipment, and then you can just do Q&A. And I was there last year, and then they have the Academy, which is actually sectioned off with a big screen where you can do PowerPoint presentations, and that's the science-oriented stuff. So I think they've got me doing a practical demonstration at Evolution of Bodybuilding, a seminar. I could do whatever I want. It's just like, hey, whatever you want to do. They don't try to over-engineer it at all.
That's cool.
And then Jordan and I are going to do a Q&A.
I saw Saturday. That. That'll be fun. That'll be really fun.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll get packed. That might be the only thing he's doing.
Really?
Of that kind. I think, I don't know. Last year, they have a pro show. I think it was a PCA show. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's a PCA show, which is the organization that Jordan's show was promoted through. That was the show that he did, the JP Classic. Yeah. So they roped him in to emceeing.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So he was standing up there with a jacket and a tie and barefoot, of course. No shoes.
I'm surprised they could get that guy in a jacket. They probably had to take two jackets and sew them together.
I was gigantic. It was hilarious.
Like, I bet.
It was so huge. He just looked, I mean, like big guys in suits do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was funny as hell. So,
like a but cartoon he knows mob boss. There. That's what I always think of when I think of like Jay Cutler in a suit.
Totally.
I think of like a cartoon mob boss, you know?
Totally. So they just kind of, he didn't know he was going to do that, but they had actually double booked him. They had booked him for seminars. I think I filled in for at least one and maybe two of his seminars last year because they had booked him at different places at the same time. And so I just said, okay, I'll fill in for you, man. So it's like, okay, no problem. So people kind of wander past, like they just sort of sit down if they like. But the Academy is kind of the same way. They've got a stadium seating in there and people will wander in and out, but it depends. It depends on who's talking and how well known they are. And then they're going to have me do some round tables too, which are fun.
Nice.
They just kind of pick a topic and then people throw questions at you.
That'll be really cool, man. I've never been to the UK. I've never been to Europe, anywhere over there, over the ocean. I've done a lot of stuff in Central America and South America, not quite South, but Central America, just about right. South America. But yeah, never been over there, man. That would be cool. And I've heard, you know, PCA. So that's what Paul Scarborough is a judge for the PCA.
Mm-hmm.
And I just spoke to James Potter, who's a competitor in Australia, and he said PCA is really big out there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're growing. I think I don't know the ins and outs of all the politics, but, you know, people can, some of the bodybuilding organizations can kind of get a little bit, you know, corrupted. You know, it's kind of the same old stuff, just human nature that happens in any organization, any institution. And PCA, I think to some degree, from what I understand without knowing the specifics, was sort of a response to, okay, let's kind of bring back the nature. This isn't about who you know and, you know, who you're coached by and this sort of thing. We're going to just actually judge this.
Yeah, yeah.
Based on your physique. And that, of course, that resonated really well with the folks in the UK.
Because, sure.
Yeah, because their mindset. So I'm glad, you know. As long as people have an outlet to, you know, fulfill their desires and you know, exercise their ambition, so to speak, pun intended.
I would love to see PCA come to the United States. I've heard a couple people say that there are plans for that to happen.
There is a show in Florida, actually.
Yeah.
In the next couple months, I saw a poster at a gym that I stopped in one weekend. I was kind of away. I had to help somebody move some things around, and I stopped in at a gym. And it's just right outside of Tampa, in Lakeland, Florida.
I should find out who's putting that together. I'd like to talk to him. If anything, just like for a small 10-15 minute interview. From what I understand, I know James. He won the overall at his show in Australia. He got paid $1,500 for that as an amateur.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's that sort of kind of confuses what it actually means to be an amateur.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because, I mean, this is a whole other topic that, you know, you could spend a whole show talking about. It's been done many times. It's a gigantic topic in ethics of sport. It is the nature of professional versus amateur, what those two things mean.
Yeah.
And I always sort of refer people to the movie Chariots of Fire, which I may even mention on this podcast here before. It's about a British sprinter, actually.
Okay.
And he may have been going to Oxford. I can't remember the university. Maybe it was Cambridge, but he was an amateur who was preparing for the Olympics. And he wanted to devote himself to sprinting more so than his studies, so to speak, which would defy the definition of amateur. That being that these endeavors are to round you out and make you more complete and whole as an individual.
Make
you more sort of a Renaissance man, so to speak.
Yeah.
But the Americans, one of the Americans who was going to be one of the front runners, had hired a coach.
Okay.
So he was paying a coach to coach him. And that, you know, by the definition, the way they considered it back then, this was in maybe the 20s, early part of last century, would make him a professional.
Huh.
And he wanted to hire a coach because he wanted to be the best he could be.
Yeah, yeah.
But then he was denying himself the personal growth and inner development that comes from learning this craft of sprinting and running on your own, because you just got, all you're doing is trying to maximize your placing with your personal development and what you've personally accomplished being secondary to that.
I know a guy in bodybuilding who said something kind of similar to that.
Right. That's why this resonates with me, you know?
Yeah.
So, that's kind of the deal. So, and of course people think professional means you're getting paid and amateur means you don't get paid.
Yeah. I thought that was the basis.
Yeah. So you can kind of define it however you want. It's really just comes down to semantics.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, heck, bodybuilding is, it's so subjective anyway.
Right.
You know, most of the divisions, like in the NPC, like there's no objective. I mean, bodybuilding is real simple. You want to be as big as you can be. You want to be as lean as you can be.
Right.
As muscle as you can be. And there's obviously some subjective symmetry and aesthetics comes with, and presentation that comes in there. But you're never going to be too lean. They're not going to say, oh, no, you were too hard.
Right. Not in bodybuilding.
You're too full. Not going to happen. But the rest of them, you know, they just shift and change like the winds, you know.
They do, yeah.
Like, you go back and look, my favorite example is go back and look at the Nationals. The first pro card given out in bikini was at the Nationals, I believe. It was in 2009.
Yeah.
The woman, beautiful woman, but she there's a picture on the cover of the NPC magazine, and she looks like she doesn't even work out.
Yeah, yeah.
She really doesn't. And now, you know, bikini competitors, you know, are going for broke, trying to get hard and stay hard all year long. And
oh yeah,
look, you know, so that's
that has evolved so fast since I remember competing on the same stage as some of the first bikini girls. This was like 2009. It had been out for maybe a year or two.
Right.
One of the girls I was up there with, I obviously didn't compete against her, but I competed, you know, the same day as her. She mm-hmm. ended up winning the overall and then did another show. And then she went to national. She turned pro. And I look at her pictures today. And yeah, she looks like she, I mean, and no offense to her, because she looked great at the time. Nothing like the girls today, like nothing. She looked like she didn't lift weights. I mean, just the level they take their butts alone. Like they're mm-hmm. the glute training. I work with girls, some girls that train their glutes like three times. They're training legs, lower body, three times a week. You know, they have all the specialized stuff and they're taking
only
it
three?
To like this. Yeah, right.
Every day.
They're taking it to this new level, man. It's just, it's so next level. It's so different. And honestly, man, I kind of like the bikini division now. I'm not going to lie. It's not like my favorite thing, but I coach girls in bikini and it is, they are doing some weird stuff. Like it's not anything that's not natural, anything that's not normal. I like it. And so they're pushing it now. I'll tell you that much. They're pushing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I do wish that, and this is just me maybe being old fashioned.
Yeah.
I still feel like, the posing could be, I mean, I think if you took, maybe it would be interesting to see what would happen if you did this. You sort of went into, you know, maybe a mall or somehow tried to do a representative sampling of women's perspectives who aren't necessarily inside the sport, because we become numb, you know, when you're in the subculture.
Right. What do you see when you look at this back shot of this bikini competitor?
What do you think about, you know, what is this woman conveying with this pose?
Right.
Are you looking at the woman's physique? Or is this overtly sexual?
They don't even pull their hair back to show their back development. In fact, I think they use their hair as a curtain to hide their backs, that just so you see the little legs and ass, and that's it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and that could even be at one point, maybe not now, but maybe 5 years ago, that was to hide musculature. They were too, you know, a lot of bikini women would have to, like, drink more water and add sodium if they were getting too hard,
because
you're trying to find
up.
That soften up a little bit. So I think there could be ways, you know, to make the posing such that it was, you would be evaluating the physique, and it could be beautiful, you know, wonderful posing, but you know, we outlawed the moon pose in bodybuilding pretty much, I think, everywhere. Because it's like, come on, man, you're mooning me.
Right.
But that's essentially what, you know, the rear pose has sort of become over the years, I think, in bikini. And you can get, I think, if you gave them some opportunity to pose or some flexibility in the quarter turns or something like that, I think you could get the same picture of the physique without the what just looks, it's just kind of the come hither thing, you know.
Yeah, you could class it up. You could class it up a little.
Certainly. And I remember listening to, I'm pretty sure, Dave Palumbo and many people who were trying to, like, literally figure out how to judge the division.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
They're like, they honestly didn't know how to judge it other than, you know, to sort of select as you would which woman is the most sexually attractive to you.
Right.
Like, how do you, like, what are we looking, what are we trying to figure out here physique wise?
Right.
So anyway, it's, we got a little off track from the amateur versus professional designation, but bodybuilding kind of does that. We've got, you know, we slide things around.
Yeah.
In those other divisions, and now we're doing it in professional versus amateur, and I think it's great to give some money back to people because we know how much goes into these shows,
right?
You know, to win something. I guess as long as you don't get, you know, hung up with the amateur versus professional designation, then it's, you know, no big deal.
I think I agree. I think it's cool, and I you know what it is too. I just like the idea of the promoters giving back. It makes me feel like that they actually do care. You know, I've been in a couple shows where I felt like it was kind of fly by night, and it became very evident quickly that they just did this as cheap as they possibly could, and it looked like a money grab, you know.
Yeah.
And then I've been in some shows where it's been really nice, high quality. You know, that they've put little details into it to make me feel like, hey, they appreciate me. And it's made me feel like, hey, I'm going to support a show like this in the future, and I'll think about this again when I want to pick a show down the road, you know. But them actually giving money back, that's huge. You know, it says a lot.
Yeah, I think, I mean, with the new show, I mean, we're coming around to the second year now for the NPC Clash of Champions that I do with Tony Torres down in Miami in October. And, you know, we didn't make any money the first year.
Yeah.
You know, we're just trying to get it up and going. And we gave back with the seminar that I organized at Tony's gym the next day.
That looked great, by the way.
Yeah, it was bizarre because it really wasn't all that well attended. If that were in the UK, for instance, oh my God, people would have been like, you know, outside in the parking lot, you know.
Right.
And it was a small show in terms of competitors. So it's hard for someone who doesn't have, you know, big coffers necessarily to go for the broke with, you know, the best trophies and all those sorts of things, the best venue, if they're going to end up losing like $5,000, which could happen easily.
I could appreciate that too.
Yeah. So you got to build it up and then, you know, eventually get better and better. And I mean, in Florida, I don't know how, I think there's a lot of shows up in Michigan.
We do. We have a decent amount.
Yeah, you do. So there's a lot of competition. I think they're even, I've heard, I don't know, I'm not in the know on this, but I've heard they're actually going to like be chopping away some shows here in Florida because there's so many.
That's crazy.
Yeah, they're just like, we can't, it's just, they're going to stop. I presume they're just going to have to stop giving approval for new shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Let some of the older ones drop off to bring the numbers down because, I mean, there can be like 3 or 4 NPC shows that every weekend.
Wow.
Or weekends on end.
Yeah. That's crazy, man. But you know what, too? I feel like that really helps to push the level of competition up. In a way, I mean, obviously it gives everybody an opportunity to come back and do better and everybody can get their first place if they compete often enough. But the more times I compete, I feel like the better I get. You know, if I only compete at one show and then I don't have any other options, then I'm done for the year. But I think it's great, man, when you can get back out there 3 weeks later and, you know, tweak things, play with it and try to improve. And I love that idea. Let me ask you something. This is something I'm not familiar with down there. Do you guys have like a tier system where there's like a tier one, tier two type thing for contests?
Yeah, there is a level system. And,
okay.
I'm not even sure where and when that applies, to be honest.
Okay.
Our show is a national qualifier, and of course you have to pay for that. Like that's something you pay extra for when you're getting sanctioned by the NPC to do the show.
Okay.
But, you know, those levels, I don't know. I don't always see those associated with different shows.
Okay.
And I don't even know. I mean, I've asked Tony, I think, because that was one of my first questions. Like, so what's this with this level thing? And I don't think he was even, and he's a judge. I'm not sure he even was able to give me an answer. Sorry, Tony, if you hear this and you actually do, and I did, and I'm claiming your
ignorance. Weren't listening or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a show that was called actually Anna Level is the promoter of the show, is the Anna Level show, ironically enough. And I needed to do that to qualify to do the Team Universe for the first time.
Yeah.
And I have no idea what level it was. I have none of that was anywhere on. It may have been somewhere in the fine print or someplace on the application, but I don't remember seeing that at all.
Okay. Well, so, I just thought I'd ask because I hadn't talked to anybody who actually had the answer on it.
Yeah. I mean, I've looked it up online and I didn't find a whole lot that really clarified for me. So, but you know, the show's happening every weekend. That's obviously, you know, that can only happen because we have these divisions now. Really, because bodybuilders, I think what you're saying, I absolutely agree with. It's nice to be able to like string 2 or 3 shows together and get better and tweak some things. But you can't stay, you know, within weeks of true contest condition as a bodybuilder.
No.
For the most part, and not fade. Unless you're, you know, making bank because you're a pro. You know?
And
even then, everyone needs to step back and come back in.
You know? Yeah.
Heck, Ronnie Coleman had a hard time doing both the Arnold and the Olympia. That's why our Mr. Olympia doesn't most of the time chance it by doing both of those shows.
Sure, sure.
You know, and that's just spread out over the entire course of the year. So, but with Men's Physique, and I don't know about classic bodybuilding so much. Those guys aren't, the ideas are not pushing it so hard in terms of the things that can have more dire health consequences, but they're still staying lean.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think they do. You're right. I think a lot of them do.
Yeah, yeah.
It just becomes, you know, we've got the really good, the excellent and really good genetics and right. the average genetics.
Right.
And then you end up depending on, you know, how big you can possibly get.
Right, right. But
yeah, so, and I mean, gosh, most, I talked to some of the competitors. Our show had like maybe 60 some competitors. So I got to talk to almost everybody, and a lot of the bikini competitors, you know, they were just, there's a show every weekend.
Oh yeah. You could just knock those out every weekend, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Almost.
It becomes almost like, you know, you don't even, that's what your social engagement is. Like, oh, keep myself busy. I'll just do a show every weekend.
Yeah. I think they called a comp. Going to do a comp this weekend.
Do a comp. Yeah.
Hey, yeah. One thing I want to tell you, this is a totally different topic. You know, a while back I talked about splitting my chest training up, breaking it down, doing less chest training more often.
Right.
I have found my pecs look better than they ever have. They've grown Sweet. More than they ever have. Yeah.
Awesome.
I had a hard time. Because, you know, a lot of times I have gone to train with Shelby for back day, and that's always on a Wednesday. Okay. And it kind of throws me off because it's hard to train back two times a week and then train with somebody that does like an all out back day that's, you know, 2 hours long.
Right.
Because when I do chest, it's only two exercises. I haven't been training with him lately. I decided I'm going to pull the trigger on this. Starting yesterday, I broke it down further and I just did two exercises for back. And so that's where I'm going to go with this with back now. And I think it's going to work because I get really sore. My back is really sore today. I'll tell you what, just doing pull-ups, man, my back gets so sore from those things. And if I can do this and then recover and then do it again, you know, 4 days later, something like that, I might not always be able to hit, let's say, you know, Monday and Thursday. It might end up being like Monday and then Thursday and then Tuesday. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It might end up taking like a little bit longer to recover to be able to, you know, maybe every 8 days or something like that. But that's the game plan now. And I think that that's going to make a difference for me.
Right. And I know with chest, you had some work done that took care of the bicipital impingement were having.
It's still there to an extent. It's not good. It's not great, but I have my good days and I have my not so good days. But listen, if I'm training chest twice a week, I may have a not so great day, but I can still get, you know, activation in the muscle. And then I come back 4 days later and maybe I have a good day that day. So it's up and down, but I have decent days more often than not.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great to hear, man. So, yeah, that was, I think we first broached that topic when Jordan was still with us.
Yeah.
And we both kind of gave you the same bits and pieces of advice. And there you go. That's awesome, man.
Yeah, I've been doing too. One of the suggestions you had made to me was, you know, Jordan had said that, you know, look at your back. It's definitely plenty thick, but it could use to be wider. You know, when we talked about lat activation. You know, I've been doing pre-fatiguing where I would say start with something like a pullover type movement and then go into pull downs and then go into my rows after I've already activated the lats and whatnot. I have done that and I do feel like that's helped, but I just think that the pull-ups themselves, pull-ups just tear me up and I feel it just like from the armpit down. So I'm thinking that that's going to be part of the back day every time I do it.
Mm-hmm. You know, Dave Henry obviously has one of the best backs in bodybuilding.
Absolutely.
He's got a great back. And I don't know. I can't remember before he and I started training, he had been training for a while, obviously before that.
Sure.
But he used to start every day with like, I wanted to say 10 sets of chins.
Wow. Really?
Something like that. Yeah. He was doing a lot, you know, pretty high volume training, kind of, you know, traditional bro split type of training. But he built a lot of the foundation of his back doing just chin after. I mean, he can and he can, you know, bang out a set of 20 of those easily, you know.
Yeah, so, I've talked to other guys that do that. You know, other guys that have good backs that have started every workout, say, you know, with pull ups or chin ups.
Yeah. So you're onto something, man. Are you, so are you now you've got back and chest on a higher frequency regimen. Are you going to leave legs less frequent?
I think so. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Okay.
I think that for me, you know what? I get a lot of enjoyment out of my longer leg days. For me, it's fun to get in there and just you know, and my legs are probably my better, one of my better body parts, you know, in general. So I think that if I can keep doing that, and they'll keep growing. So it seems to be working, I guess what I'm saying.
Well, obviously, you know, calves, you'll never need the training.
Right. And I've gotten to the point where quads have caught up, you know, they're not
really.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They're caught up. They're not as good as calves are, but they don't look too small, you know?
Okay.
So I'll take that.
I wonder, I mean, I know you like it, but I wonder just what would happen, you know, if you decided just to go all in with the strategy that you suspect is going to work.
Yeah.
And just split the legs up into a higher frequency. Just took the volume and spread it out.
I've done the whole like quads on one day, hams on another day thing. So I have done that for long periods of time, like, you know, 4 or 5 months at a time. And I feel like I've always wanted to go back to just the full day of legs. And I think they take longer to recover too, is another part of it, just because I'm doing those long workouts. So
of course,
I'm not, if my legs don't grow, if my back grows more and my chest grows more, I'll take that. And I think that the legs will still look okay. So I figured you would appreciate that though. Idea of, you know, higher frequency, lower volume, basically.
Yeah. Well speaking of Jordan, volume,
really.
One thing that's interesting is that he's gone back to, it's not exactly, you know, one of the standard versions of fortitude training, but he's gone back to something akin to that. And he's done exactly what I want people to do. I think, like I mentioned when we were talking with Paul Scarborough, is he's fashioned it to fit him, his own recovery, relative recovery, muscle group by muscle group. And what he's doing actually is upper body at what sounds like pretty close to the frequency that you are, but he's training legs 3 times a week right now.
3 times.
Yeah. Which is the standard way to, that's so funny. Like, what if I said he does 3 sets a week? You'd be like, what?
Yeah.
But if you say he trains 3 times a week, like, what? And it's just, he keeps the volume low.
Yeah.
The volume to where he can recover it. And he's found, he's got an injury. He's coming back from it, but it required that he do some things, that he switch some of his exercises up.
Okay.
He could do a lot of hip extension types of things. So he's been doing some, you can see it on his Instagram. He's been doing some, I think he was doing 5-plate Smith sissy squats, basically using the sissy squat bench in the Smith machine, and squatting down, which basically, precludes him doing a whole lot of hip extension and glute activation, which was bothering this bizarre injury. But anyway, he's finding, and this makes sense given some of the things that he and I went through when I was helping him out, that he needs the higher frequency for legs to keep his leg size.
Yeah.
So when he's dieting down. So he's figured out what you have for upper body, but he's going the other way for lower body.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is. The interesting thing too is that, you know, obviously he can train really friggin' hard.
Yeah.
And he's obviously really advanced. His legs are gigantic, but he's finding that 3 times a week is better for his leg size.
Huh.
Which is what the opposite of most people might guess.
Yeah.
Is going to happen.
But like you said, he's doing probably a lot less per time.
Of course. Yeah. That's all really, I mean, that's the simple adjustment that is sort of kind of a mind fuck, pardon the French, but
yeah,
it's like three times a week. It's like, yeah, but you're not doing that much. It's just the volume really low. So
yeah, my back volume is going to be the same, you know, whether I do it once or twice.
Oh, really? You're keeping the volume per workout the same?
No. I the same over a week span.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Your week volume's the same. Got it.
Yeah, yeah. And
okay. Yeah,
and
that's the way to do it.
And that'll give me an opportunity too, if I do want to get back out to train with Shelby and Bill Toko, which I'm sure that I will in the future, I could switch it for a couple of weeks, you know, and just go down to one time a week and get out there and hit it hard for a couple hours with them.
I think there's something to say for frequency auto-regulation and frequency periodization.
Hmm.
I mean, that's essentially, this has kind of come up in various places, conversations I've been having, but that's essentially what I've kind of built into the fortitude training and what seems to work with a taper. And someone was saying this, I can't even remember where it was on Facebook or maybe it was on my board.
Yeah,
I think it was actually on Facebook. And this guy had found that he was training muscle groups three times a week, and doing okay with that, but doing better when he went to two times a week. Hmm. But in retrospect, he recognized that he was getting those improvements at the two times a week frequency only when it was preceded by the three times a week frequency.
Weird. Interesting.
It's actually not that weird. That's
interesting. It's weird to me. Like, I wouldn't have thought that. I wouldn't have thought, hey, this is what we should do. Put it that way.
Yeah. Well, that's essentially what functional overreaching is about.
Hmm.
Is that you're creating, quote, inroads. Some people are just calling this fatigue. You know, the extent to which your system's recuperative abilities have been imposed upon.
Yeah.
People just call that fatigue. Like Mike Israetel calls it fatigue. A lot of people call it fatigue. And I would never call that fatigue, because fatigue is an entirely different concept in exercise physiology than that. We can get into that maybe. That could be a little topic of a Scott rant, but
duly noted. Yeah. I'm noting right now.
Right. Yeah. Right on. But yeah, so you're setting yourself up with functional overreaching, meaning that you're pushing to the point where you're not necessarily making progress. You know, in an athletic context, this would be, you know, in terms of your speed, your strength, or what have you, until you back off. And then you overreach, and it's functional if the performance improvements, or in this case, the muscle growth, comes when you back off. And this is a reduction in frequency from, in this guy's case, three times to two times a week, which is almost, it's pretty much exactly what I have in fortitude training, when people go from a blast, where they're training most muscle groups three times a week, or even four if they're using the turbo version, but most people use the basic. And then you go into the deload, which is, I call it an intensive cruise. You still train as hard, but you reduce the volume and you reduce the frequency. And you take the last part of that period completely off, and you come back overreached. And if you've done things right, and, you know, of course, your diet has to be in line too. And that's what that guy had. He kind of figured out in the course of our conversation. I'll have to find that post, because I'm not getting all the notifications on Facebook. I keep on missing things for some reason. But yeah, so that's what you might find. Back to you, what made me think of all this is, if you're going twice a week like that, and then, like, maybe you set up a month or so where you're just training with those guys.
Yeah.
Assuming you don't just absolutely decimate yourself with those workouts.
Right.
But you may be able to get some overreaching, get some growth out of that, if you got all the other bits and pieces in place, like your diet and sleep and recovery basics.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Because you're setting up and the mechanisms for this. I mean, who knows? It's sort of, and we know we have a repeated bout effect. When you get sore, you do something that's novel, especially with lots of lowering eccentric contractions, you have this repeated bout effect.
Yeah.
You do it once and then you don't get nearly as sore. And it hasn't been followed up that much to know, like, to what extent does this effect compound over repeated workouts. But anyone who's been training a long time is, like, let's say you're not doing, like, I don't know, rack deads or something that typically just makes you sore as shit.
Yeah.
You may find this with the chins. First time you did it, you got really sore. The next time you did it, you got pretty dang sore. The next time you did it, you got pretty dang sore. And eventually, three or four workouts into that, you're not quite as sore.
Right.
It's definitely not sore as you were. So it sort of tapers off, and your body adjusts to that. And part of that adjustment, it's repeated bout effect, which can actually last a long time, though, is I think you're going to be recovering in your case relative to a twice a week frequency.
Right.
So your body is basically adapting to some degree, I think, probably to the temporal spacing of your workout. So you train every 3 or 4 days, you train back every 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
It's thinking, okay, it's adapting in a way that I got to be ready in the next 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
And that won't necessarily happen, I don't know, with like a bro split training once a week.
Okay.
Because there's no repeated bout that comes back before your recovery maybe is complete. So the frequency, I think, does something up, and this is a whole other topic as well, but it does something in terms of speeding recovery between bouts.
That's interesting.
This is a really kind of a rough concept. I'm kind of fishing out in my head as I speak, so I'm stumbling on my words a little bit.
But I follow you.
Yeah. So then now you're used to training twice a week.
Yeah.
That's basically, you've set your system up for that, obviously with lower volume, and you come back in and you train with those guys and maybe you do twice the volume, but you've still got a system that is set up to adapt, set up to recover with twice a week.
Yeah.
Training frequency. So, you'll recover, you know, more rapidly.
Right.
If you preceded those training sessions with Bill and Shelby with the twice a week frequency than if you've just been doing once a week frequency.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I could totally see that as being a possibility.
Because you kind of set up that pattern. Yeah. So you might get more sore. You probably will, because your volume will be higher and you know, training with those guys, you may train a little bit harder. You'll do different exercises.
Right.
But I think it'll be to your advantage to have been training more regularly. This repeated bout thing, it can last actually months. They demonstrated that, you know, it's really a prolonged effect. But there's numerous mechanisms that are potentially involved there, and some of it is neurological, I think.
Yeah.
Because the activation patterns are kind of wonky when you're doing a novel exercise, and they get better and cleaner.
Yeah.
In terms of just the firing rates that are going on in some of the motor units and synchronization and those sorts of things. So, but some of it's also immunological and inside the muscle cell too, in terms of the repair processes. So anyway, it'd be interesting to see if you do that. Like if you take a leap forward and functionally overreach when you drop down to once a week back with those guys.
That could be interesting. Now I'll want to find out.
I do too. Cause I've mentioned before when people would do their first or their second cruise, if they like get everything lined up with fortitude training, they'll come back and they're like, they're like, what the fuck? I must've wrote down the wrong weights in my training. I can't believe this.
You have mentioned that before. Yeah.
Yeah. It's this. I love that. I just freaking love it when that happens. You know, people get so excited. So, yeah.
Well, hey, what do you say we take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, tackle a couple questions?
Let's do it.
All right, guys, we will be back in a moment. If you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at fortitudetraining.net. And if you order any of his products or services, you get a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. Go to fortitudetraining.net to learn more about all these products, services, and events offered by Scott Stevenson. Hey guys, Scott McNally here.
And this is VJ Peary.
You guys know us from here at the Advices Radio Network. Well, we also have another show, Bodybuilding Nerds Radio. We've got everything from supplement reviews
to shout outs,
listener questions,
and of course, our weekly bodybuilding podcast reviews.
So check us out every Friday.
Or whenever you feel like cooking or doing your cardio or basically wasting time with us.
You can hear us at bodybuildingnerds.com.
Also on iTunes. Bodybuilding Nerds, it's time to get nerdy. We'll be right back.
right, guys, welcome back to the show. Scott, I am drinking a kombucha as we speak.
Ooh, which brand is this? This is the one you've mentioned before, I think.
This is a Kavita. This is a Kavita grapefruit kombucha.
Ooh, so it's nice and acidic.
It's, yeah, that's what I like. I like the acidity. I like the pop, you know, there's like a, there's
yeah,
like a bite to it, you know?
I love that too. I love carbonation and the bite.
Yeah.
You know that if you give a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor with a carbonated drink, you don't, supposedly, I have never done this, but I've read this, that you won't, the carbonation doesn't give you that carbonated feeling when you drink.
Huh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I've got a soda stream. It's a carbonates my water.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so you stick it up in the machine and the little nozzle goes into the fluid and the water you have in there. And you press the button and it just drives pressurized CO2 into your water. And then you can add a mix. They sell their own flavors and I use other stuff. If you... one thing I've noticed, depending on what I add to it afterwards, if I add like a citrus flavor, that's going to be more acidic. So that adds protons.
Huh.
And if you look at the, obviously people can't see what I'm sort of, I'm waving my hands in front of me, but if you look at the equation for, it's an equilibrium equation between bicarbonate and a proton and carbonic acid and then CO2 and H2O on one end. So carbon dioxide is the water, or is the gas, and then you've got carbonic acid, which is got the proton on there, and then you've got bicarbonate and the proton itself. If you add to those protons, you drive the reaction the other way, and more CO2 would come off. That's okay. Just basic, like kind of basic chemistry.
Hmm.
Well, that's what happens. Like I've got this carbonated water, and I drop in like a citrusy flavor,
yeah,
an orange, and then I got to be careful because the thing will just bubble over the bottle every time.
That's crazy.
And that happens with caffeine too. Sometimes I'll make a caffeinated morning beverage that way.
Okay.
And I'll add the caffeine there because the caffeine doesn't mix very well.
Hmm.
But I have to be careful. If I try to carbonate as much, it'll just make an explosion.
Wow.
Huh. Yeah. So there's the chemistry, my chemistry insight for the day.
It's the chemistry minute on Muscle Minds. So guys, we are back. Dr. Yep. Scott Stevenson, fortitudetraining.net. Check it out. And we've got a bunch of questions here. We are over at the Advices Forum, forum.advicesradio.com. And in the bodybuilding section, there are threads stickied for all the shows. And we are in the Muscle Minds thread. Next question. Now, he lets us know that he did post this question as well in the clinical muscle section for Dr. Ogden. This is Lucky 13. He says, Dr. Ogden mentioned might be caused by low blood pressure, but I've even tested my blood pressure. It looks fine around 120 over 80. Since this doesn't look like the issue, I thought Dr. Scott Stevenson might have some ideas. So just to remind you, my question was, hi guys, great show. And hello from the UK. So you might be seeing him next weekend.
Lucky 13. Okay. Power.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And another UK listener. I've been using DHT blockers such as like Propecia, Avodart, even Sal Palmetto for 10 years. And this is for limiting alopecia and protecting my prostate from the effects of DHT. The issue I have is this causes a tension in my chest. It feels very much like a surge of adrenaline, and I'm sure it could be described as anxiety. My question is, why is this happening, and what biological process could be going on within my body to cause this? I'm also looking for an idea of potential blood tests I could use to find out what my body is overproducing to cause this. Lowering or stopping the DHT blockers isn't an option. He's 33 years old. He's 5'10", 205, He does TRT dose of test for the last 5 years. No other super supplements. About 10% body fat. He says, really, it's via a 5-point calibers. And he's been training for 15 years.
So the interesting thing, I would first suggest that you can go on scholar.google.com or pubmed.com and just type in finasteride syndrome. Finasteride syndrome. Yeah. It's associated with erectile dysfunction.
I've heard that.
Yeah. And loss of sex drive and basically sort of all the things that you would get from having a fully functional hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis with good testosterone. It's not everybody. They've seen threads. I always sort of click on the threads or posts about this. And some people claim they don't have these issues.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. But a lot of people do. And I've had clients with it too. And we're talking like you use dutasteride or finasteride for, you know, a year or so, and then try to come off it, stop using it, maybe because they're not cycling anymore, whatever it might be, and then they've got erectile dysfunction.
Oh, geez.
Sexual side effects. Yeah.
Coming off of it, they do.
Yeah, sometimes with while they're on it, too.
Yeah, I've heard that. I didn't realize it was coming off it, too.
I don't know that the etiology here is known. It creates some kind of dysregulation. I don't know if there's an androgen receptor downregulation or, you know, some of the second messenger systems get thrown out of whack. I don't know. I've not been able to find any mechanism, but if there's numerous papers out there documenting this. It's not good. It's not good at all. It can be kind of, you know, devastating to your psyche. Of course, then you get depressed. It's like, what the fuck? Yeah. You know, I just wanted to keep my hair and, you know, my prostate from enlarging. And, you know, now it doesn't make a difference because I'm not interested in looking good or using my prostate. So I would definitely check into that. So the other thing is, it sounds like, let's see, looking at the question here, the issue I have is this causes a tension in my chest. So I'm guessing that he's taking the drug or any of these three things, the salt palmetto or the finasteride, dutasteride, and then he's getting this tension and the anxiety shortly thereafter. And I'd have to go and look up the half-life of those drugs to see. And it seems like it happens maybe with all of them or maybe just those two, but – or just, you know, just the finasteride, dutasteride, maybe not the salt palmetto, but that sounds like he might be having an adverse reaction to something in the drug other than, just guessing here, you know, I can't diagnose this, of course, but other than the active ingredient. Like literally, you know, some filler or something in there is something his body's reacting to.
I just looked up Propecia, and it says 4.7 to 7.1 hours.
Yeah, yeah. Usually they're, you know, once a day or twice a day prescribed. So, I mean, if he's getting it, it's the timing matters here. You know, if he takes it and, you know, it's in his system and 15 minutes later he's getting this anxiety.
Yeah.
That's not probably when the drug is peaking. And, you know, you have to look at the sort of the temporal profile of the side effects versus what you would expect the pharmacokinetics of the drug to be. So, if this drug's going to have would you expect a peak effect somewhere around the time when the blood levels are peaking, then you would also expect potentially those side effects to be happening at about the same time. That isn't necessarily the case. Yeah. Like with the finasteride syndrome, it's not necessarily the case because it's a different mechanism. But this sounds like he's talking about an acute effect of taking any of those three things. And so that would be the important thing to figure out what it is. The other thing though, it sounds like he's probably getting angina. Like his tension is just getting, anxiety. These are the types of things that happen when that precede a myocardial infarction, a heart attack, due to impaired coronary artery flow.
Phew. That sounds scary.
Yeah, well, that's like I'm getting anxious and I'm having, you know, tension in my chest. I'm trying to I'm painting the picture as bleakly as I can so that he'll, you know, get this fixed. Hopefully, maybe he's figured this out since posting this question.
Yeah,
that's what I would literally consider, without knowing exactly, you know, when the symptoms come on, relative to taking the drug. Or there may be, like, he may just be making this association for whatever reason, and he hasn't necessarily thought it through. He just seems to think the two are connected because he's not using anything else. Maybe he was on TRT for a while and didn't cause any issues, and then he started taking these things and slowly started having issues. I mean, these could be, I'm not an expert on finasteride syndrome, but these could be the kind of things that some people get. This may be, he may be among a subset of individuals who, when they get a finasteride syndrome, and a syndrome is just a cluster of symptoms with unknown etiology. They don't know what necessarily causes them. So if you go to the doctor, it's nice to say, hey, you've got this, you've got syndrome X, Y, and Z, because okay, good. Now I can look that up and I can look into it and educate myself. But sometimes they'll diagnose you with the syndrome, and that's like going in and say, doc, I got a headache, and they say, I'm going to diagnose you with headache syndrome.
Right.
What is that? It's the syndrome that you have when you have a headache. It's like, you haven't told, that's doublespeak. What are you talking about? That means nothing. So like a set of symptoms makes a syndrome, but it doesn't tell you necessarily what to do in terms of directly treating it. Obviously there are things that can be done, but so yeah, I would treat that like as a symptom unto itself and go see a doctor. You know, if you're having chest pain and anxiety, you may be having heart palpitations too, which is just the perception of some unusual beat. A palpitation is just anything that feels weird in your heart. Like you feel like you skipped a beat. It doesn't tell you necessarily what actually is going on with the heart or the heart's conductive system. So anyway, I wanted to answer that one. I don't know if Dr. Ogden mentioned anything other, if they even answered this question, but the finasteride syndrome is kind of a big one, I think, because it really messes people up, and it's
I've heard that.
Yeah, yeah, it's a shame to see, you know.
Yeah, you know what I've used, and I don't know how helpful it is for. Hopefully it helps with hair loss. Have you heard of people using Nizoral shampoo? For supposedly it washes the scalp, it removes the DHT, something along those lines, keeps the hair follicles from getting clogged up. But you have to use the 2%, I guess, or what the studies were done on. I have a prescription for that, just for that purpose, and I use it every time I wash my hair, just about. I can't tell you though whether it's worked or not for hair loss, because obviously I've used it, you know what I mean? I have nothing to compare it to.
Right. Well, you didn't. You weren't having hair loss that stopped when you started using the.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. It's got an antifungal in there, you know. So that's, you know, if you have like an ongoing infection, you know, you can end up kind of getting scarring in the hair follicles.
Okay.
And then they just don't grow hair very well.
You know? I see.
Just like in any skin, you know, if you get a scar there, you're not going to have hair necessarily coming out because the scar tissue is basically placing the regular skin. But
that makes sense.
I mean Rogaine works pretty well for stopping things for lots of folks.
Okay.
And yeah, and I can't say there's absolutely no evidence of this or no one's had this issue, but I mean that's a topical, and the idea is that it, you know, it gets in and it works just locally, so it's not acting systemically in the way that so that's going to help with hair, but not prostate. I don't
right.
think you can put Rogaine on your taint.
Topical prostate.
I've never thought of that concept. I'm sure someone's tried it.
If
someone's listening to this and they want to stop and Google Rogaine taint, they will probably find some hits. But the topical seems to help a lot of guys. And there's all sorts of stuff. There's RU something, I forget the numbers that people are playing around with. There's all sorts of research chemicals that people use, but you can get minoxidil on eBay or all over the place.
Yeah.
Seems to help a lot of folks. So
the next question, this guy asked in all the forums about any movements or stretches you guys recommend for posterior pelvic tilt. And we didn't answer him on blood, sweat, and gear. I know that.
Yeah, I have an answer. I can.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. The next question here, I don't know if you have anything for this one, Scott. He says, any movements or stretches you guys would recommend for posterior pelvic tilt?
So I'm presuming he actually does mean posterior pelvic tilt, because a lot of people are more worried about anterior pelvic tilt.
So what? Explain the difference to me here so I can picture this in my head.
So if you think of your, I wish I could draw, people could see what, we're going to have to go with the Joe Rogan type deal. We're on YouTube. And
And you could have your dry erase board behind you.
Exactly. Exactly. So your pelvis, if imagine someone, imagine a bikini competitor.
Yes.
And they're facing the curtain, and they arch their back, and what they're with that lordosis there, or hyperlordosis, you could also characterize that as having anterior pelvic tilt.
Okay.
So that's kind of sticking out.
It shifts his, out.
Yeah. So in his case, he's got posterior pelvic tilt. So if you sort of look at the iliac crest on the top of the pelvis, and if you just sort of rotate anything backwards, so where your low back is like arching like a cat would, which is not where you want to be, like for instance on a heavy deadlift, although some guys who are the best in the world do that. They just have backs made of, you know, adamantium or something.
Right.
That's how a lot of people injure their backs.
Okay.
Because they've got a lumbar kyphosis, essentially. That's what that is, as opposed to lordosis, which is the normal lumbar curvature. So that's probably, if that's really what's going on, it's probably a matter of his seated posture. I bet if you looked at him sitting, if he's like at his computer listening to this right now, it's probably his low back is totally bowed out.
Mm.
If he's not leaning against something, a lumbar roll could help. So, to sort of, put that back behind there. Muscles will adjust their length based on, the habitual length that they're sort of presented with in your day to day life. So this is why, you know, guys will blow out their midsections if they're eating a massive amount of food, and they always have a food baby.
Yeah.
Is the muscle stretch. I've talked about this before on the show too. So he's probably got that posterior pelvic tilt all the time. So those lumbar erector spinae muscles are stretched. And if you use the lumbar roll, that would push him into a more lordotic posture in the low back.
Hmm.
And then that would help shorten them up. Also, it would train his nervous system. You've got a lot of those postural muscles are just, they're controlled reflexively. So you've got stretch receptors and other proprioceptors that are kind of keeping your spine in line, and his are all set up to have him in that posterior pelvic tilt position. So a lumbar roll, he'd have to make sure that he trains his erector spinae. So if he's doing like bent over rows and deadlifts and squats, he's got to really train that. He might want to do hyperextensions as well, just to train that musculature so he can hold that position, because everything's just probably lax back there.
Hmm.
And you know, normally people have too much anterior pelvic tilt, but his is the opposite. So for anterior pelvic tilt, you would stretch the hip flexors, but in his case, he'd want to tighten them up, strengthen them. So he could actually do if he does like crunches or sit-ups would actually be a good thing for him. Just because you're going to get so much hip flexor activation with those. I sometimes have, I kind of call these floating crunches. I may have a video. I think I have a video on my Instagram. It's probably like a year or two old now.
Okay.
Where you get on a decline bench. So you you can use one that's got a bar on it or just a regular one. And you kind of lean yourself back to where your upper body's at about a 45 degree angle. And then you just do crunches. Only moving the lumbar spine. So you're just doing flexion extension of the lumbar spine, which trains the abs.
Hmm.
But to hold your body in that position, your hip flexors have to be strong. And if they're not, you can't hold that position. your hip flexors will give out and he'll just fall back before you you fatigue the abs. So he could try something like that. So ab work that trains his hip flexors would help. And then he's going to have to make sure he's got a lumbar, a lordotic curvature all the time when he's going around, because he's probably used to picking up stuff with his back rolled over all the time. And I wouldn't suggest, like, you see people sometimes like big department stores, you know, sometimes like Home Depot. I'm not so much anymore. Maybe they kind of figured this out. People have the belts they'll wear like permanently. If they've had a back injury, like someone working maybe at Walmart where they're moving boxes around or they have to pick up heavy stuff and they'll wear a belt all the time. That would kind of hold him in lumbar curvature, but it'll probably weaken the musculature because then he doesn't have the normal reflexive tone that has to hold there. So he's going to have to be mindful like all the time of this. He's trying to reset his posture. And that's tough. So a lumbar roll, train the hip flexors, do everything, make sure he picks stuff up with his legs, you know, the standard rhetoric on that, keeping a lumbar curvature. And then he probably has really tight hamstrings and probably glutes as well. But my guess is that his hamstrings are just tight as all get out. They're just like piano cord. You can imagine someone with really tight hamstrings and like they've got to reach down and pick up something off the ground.
Yeah.
And all the bending happens in their back and like none of it happens in their hamstrings where their hips are flexing forward. Because they're flexible in their back. So he's probably, his hamstrings are probably just, you know, tight as anything. So a lot of stretching and then all those other things I mentioned and, that should help, but he's probably the thing that we'd be concerned about is if he starts to train heavy and he gets stronger this way, the posterior discs in your lumbar spine, some of this is a function of that, you know, we've only been walking upright, I don't know how long, but our spines are sort of seem to have evolved for quadrupedal motion, not bipedal motion.
Really?
Yeah, that's kind of why we have the arch that we do. You know, you look at, even look at chimps. You know, they can walk upright, but they spend a lot of time, like, you know, bent over and walking on all fours. So, you know, there's a whole evolutionary design thing here, you know, with having the big brains and walking upright so we can see over, you know, planes and have a better perspective. And our backs are not really set up so much for walking upright in terms of the relative strengths of the mechanical structures there. So the posterior discs are – the posterior walls of the discs are really weak. That's why almost all the time – I don't know what the percentage is. It's got to be above 90% of the time. When people herniate a disc, it's a posterior herniation. There's also some – there's a big ligament in the front of the spine that kind of holds things from going that direction, and that's because we were – you know, the spine is engineered very much like a quadruped spine. It's got a lot more similarities there. There's not many bipedal animals, but we've got a quadruped spine, but we're bipedal animals. So we've got kind of a mismatch. So if he starts doing like, you know, lots of heavy shit and he lets his lumbar spine become kyphotic like that and flex rather than keeping that normal, like anatomical lumbar curvature, he doesn't have to become hyperlordotic and overarch, but that's probably safer than the other way. But if he goes the other way and lets his lumbar spine, that's the mechanism of low back injury with so many people. And that posterior wall, the disc will just go, and the nucleus pulposus, the jelly material inside there will push out. And then you got nerve impingement, sciatica, and all those wonderful things.
Well, sadly, that makes sense.
Yeah. There's the anatomy lesson for the day on the low spine.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time here. I have to make a doctor's appointment. We only had enough time for a couple of quick questions. And I know you were traveling over the weekend, so we'll get this out, though, normal time. It'll be out on Thursday. We did have one more message here I wanted to share. And this one brought a smile to my face. He says, no question here, but I just finished listening to Muscle Minds 22, and I want to thank Dr. Scott for the laugh and the story about the intermittent fasting visionary Ted. Just thinking about that bloke trying to eat anything and everything in a 10-minute window for the day was a good laugh.
A visionary.
Yeah, this is Trab. Trab on the boards. Yeah, that was a good one. I've thought about that story more than once, man.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think about it all the time when I see people trying to, you know, instead of TED Talks, we could have TED Eats.
TED Eats.
And maybe do, if we get, like, next year at the Arnold, we'll do, like, an all-you-can-eat and see who can eat the largest mass of food, scale weight of food in 10 minutes.
Yeah. So what day did you say you are leaving for Body Power?
I'm going to leave tomorrow, Wednesday.
Leaving tomorrow. So, okay.
Yep. That'll get me there a day early.
Okay. And then that's going to happen through the weekend. And then when do you get back?
Monday.
Well, I'm excited. Are you going to be posting anything on social media through this? Will you do like some Instagram stories or something so I can follow along maybe?
What are you hinting at, Scott? I'm laughing because we had talked about this. I'm so the self-aggrandizement and glorification of like, look at me. I'm buying a coffee at the airport. Like,
yes.
Hey, that's awesome. I'll try to figure out how to force a habit of adding some bits and pieces of my trip. Maybe if I can come up with something that's really actually interesting.
Yeah.
From my standpoint, I'll add it in there.
Yeah. We'll find the little stuff interesting. If you did want to show us you buying a coffee at the airport, I want to see that personally. I want to know that Dr. Scott Stevenson just bought a coffee today. And I bet you there's going to be like 500 other people that are also going to want to know that. Uh-huh. But yeah, especially the stuff like that's going to be, you know, at the event and everything. That would be cool to see if you get a chance to pick up the old phone and capture that stuff.
You know, I was reminded of, you just reminded me of, it was a couple of weeks ago when I was coming back from the trip to St. Louis for the House of Pain gym opening.
Yeah.
And I was at my last stop the night before I was going to be home. And I went in to get, I got some gas. I wanted to gas up so I could get on the road earlier the next day. And I went into a gas station. Oh, God, where was this? This was in South Georgia someplace, kind of out of nowhere. And I go into this gas station that just so happened to have like a frozen yogurt, like mini set up there. Like they had six or eight types of frozen yogurt and two types of sorbet.
Oh, wow.
And this is at a gas station, like in the middle of nowhere. I'm like, holy crap. So I'm like, the gods have spoken. I'm having sorbet tonight.
Yeah.
And actually I trained that day. So it was a carb day and everything was good to go. And I go over to it and I try to turn it on and it was melted.
Oh no!
So their cooling mechanism, it was not working. There was actually two types of sorbet, and it was just fluid, just water. It was nothing. Mm.
I was going to say that would have made a good Instagram story.
That's what made me think of it. I'm like, this is something I got to put on Instagram because I know so many people like the sorbet thing,
right?
But then you know when it would have been, you know, sorbet tragedy basically.
Right.
But it's just been me weeping in the corner because my sorbet dreams were demolished.
But it would have drama. There would be an arc to the story. It would be interesting.
Yeah. Yes. I have to clip that out into like, you know, like a 50, 10 second clips.
Right.
You
know, right.
Me approaching and like some slow-mo and
really excited for the sorbet.
Which flavor should I choose? Which flavor have the, whatever that filter is, it flashes back and forth really quick. I'd add that one in there.
Yeah. About talking about like the benefits of sorbet at this particular time of the day and how important it is for your bodybuilding. And then you pull the trigger. Yeah, exactly.
The gong. No sorbet for you.
So are you training today, Scott?
Yeah. Last training day before I hit. You know what I found out, it just happened that this worked the last couple of times, but when I get there, I'm gonna train upper body today, and then I'll train legs, like really right when I arrive.
Okay.
I'll kind of get some of the water off, and I think I slept for like 15 hours last time after.
Wow.
I landed. I went to Emporium Gym, which is Warren Dyson's gym. It's the super busy one. They've got pictures of Kai and Phil. Daylon Bailey, a bunch of the, you know, top well-known pros or the murals in the gym. And it's a good gym. Nice. And went in there and trained and picked up some food and then went back. And I literally think I slept for 15 hours. I was so wiped out.
Wow.
So I'm going to do that. Vicky Mercetta is going to pick me up.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. So you should be there, man. Like maybe next year.
I should.
Yeah.
Well, tell Vicky I said hi. Tell Jordan I said hi. And I have a feeling you're probably going to run into some listeners, too. I know we have a lot of listeners in the UK.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Last year I did, and then even, yeah, some listeners. And just, yeah, the UK people are just awesome. It's just, it's such a good experience. Such good, just good blokes over there.
Absolutely. I like the way you threw blokes in there, just real casually.
Right, yep. I'm working on it. Wasn't cheeky or anything.
Oh, that was good. All right, guys, for another episode of Muscle Minds, I'm Scott McNally with Dr. Scott Stevenson. Cheers.
Cheers, we're out.
Voices Radio.